Welcome, friends. Welcome to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, where today we have a really special program featuring Dr. Ivar Jacobsen, who is the guy who started all the whole fuss about process. Yeah, you remember the Rational Unified Process, or RUP as it was affectionately known? Well, Dr. Jacobsen is back at process again, but this time with something that's a little friendlier, a little lighter weight, maybe a little more agile, perhaps. It's something he calls the Essential Unified Process. Well, I had the chance to sit down with a live audience at the Architecture Insight Conference in Newport, Wales. And at the beginning, well, I just had to tell a joke. Okay, it's my monologue. Okay, watch out, Jay Leno. Here I come. Let's listen in to Ivar Jacobsen. You know, getting ready to come here to this event, I stopped in at the fancy airport lounge, you know, while you're waiting for your flight, and there was this guy I know there. His name is Chris, and Chris is he's a little annoying, okay, just to be honest with you. And he saw me, and so I couldn't avoid him. So I said, "Hey, you know, how's it going, Chris?" And he started talking to me. And we're standing there chatting, and in walks Bill Gates. And Chris just went ballistic. He said, "Oh my gosh, that's Bill Gates. I can't believe Bill Gates is here. I've got to talk to Bill Gates." I said, "Chris, don't talk to him, okay? He's a nice guy, but just leave him alone." And he said, no, "I've got to talk to him. And I couldn't stop him. He went right over to Bill Gates, and he said, "Oh my gosh, you're Bill Gates. I can't believe I'm talking to Bill Gates." And Bill's like, "Yeah, it's nice to meet you too. You know, you're very nice. Thank you." And Chris says, "Hey, Bill, will you do me a favor?" And Bill said, well, "What is it?" Chris said, "Well, in a little while, I have a client coming here to meet me. And I just think it would be so great if while I'm talking with him, you would walk up and pretend like you know me." So Bill thinks about it for a moment, and he says, okay, I'll do it." So a little while later, Chris is sitting there talking with his client, and Bill Gates walks up and taps him on the shoulder and says, "Hey, Chris, how's it going?" And he says, "Take a hike, Gates. Can't you see I'm having a meeting here?" Okay, cue the music. Welcome, everyone, to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, where we are here today at the beautiful Celtic Manor Resort in Wales, where I am delighted to be joined by what looks like, I don't know, about 100 of the smartest architects I have ever seen in one place. And we are going to have just a great time on this episode of ArtCast, speaking with Ivar Jacobsen. Now, I had to think about that because, you know, Jacobsen is so similar to my name, Jacobs, that, you know, I was tempted to get it wrong. Okay, but I'm delighted to be with you. So let's welcome Ivar Jacobsen. Ivar, it's so good to be with you. I've heard so much about you over the years and the work that you've done. You've kind of been one of the legends of the industry. Does that intimidate you sometimes?
Yes. Frankly speaking. But actually, I met Bill Gates twice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he has invited me to Microsoft twice to give his talk.
Ah.
But I still have to come.
Well, tell him that joke when you get there.
I will. I have a couple of other jokes about it.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about your history. I mean, where did you start in all of this industry?
Well, I started very quickly as a project manager for developing a mission critical system at Ericsson. The interesting thing, it was a software system, a computer-based system, and I knew nothing about software. Even worse, I knew nothing about telecom. But project managers, they pick a project manager that they knew wouldn't create trouble. But they were dead wrong.
Yeah, so you whipped those guys right into shape, didn't you?
Well, I don't know if that's the way to say it, but actually, I, as I said, I knew nothing about software, so I had to work at night understanding what they were doing. At that time, the only thing we did was coding, and it's assembler. So how do you learn about software? Reading code and rereading code. And after 3 months, I thought I understood what people were doing. We have 75 people, so it was quite a big project. So after
Wait a minute. After 3 months of reading assembler, you understood what they were doing?
I think so. I actually, every day I came back to work, and then I had a long list of questions that I asked people who had done it. So they taught me mouth to mouth.
Ah, okay.
And it took 3 months, and when I remember, I felt I understood it. So my discovery was that what we were developing would never ever become a product. The goal was that this was mission critical. The goal was that we would be able to deliver this to every customer around the world. Ericsson did tailor-made systems, so it was not a system like in US at that time. They had one customer, and they had the same kind of system to everybody. But we had to make tailor-made systems, and today we call it software reuse.
Yeah, wow. So eventually, you know, like most people, I heard about your name in conjunction with process. And okay. Now it's understandable to me because you came from wearing the project manager hat, which is somebody who obviously has to think about process. Now, earlier we were talking about the earliest phase of software where there really wasn't process. It was more like the chaos of the early Earth.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, this is the way I have divided the time. So we had a time when we had no process, an era. And in fact, there are many parts of the world that still are there. No process. And then we have a time when we talk a lot about process. It's the process era. That's where we are, most of us. And we talk a lot about process. We have all kinds of processes. We have unified process, like processes. We have CMMI process. We have agile methods. That's also kind of process. But the next era will be what I call invisible process, yet very present. For instance, if you drive a car, you really don't really read a manual to see how you are going to drive.
No, but you do talk on the mobile phone, though, at the same time.
Yes, and, but that is intuitive. Now, okay. In fact, the mobile phone is not very intuitive. I mean, how many of you know the more than 10% of the features of a mobile phone? Well, not many.
Yeah.
So we are very technology. We have to learn, and we don't use all the features that they give us.
Now, I thought it was interesting. We did go through this phase where there was so much talk about process, mm-hmm. but it seemed to me that though there was some benefit, that most people had the sense that we weren't realizing the hoped for gains that those people who were advocating process had told us we would realize. And I just wonder, why do you think the process didn't really yield the fruit we hoped it would?
I think people in general believe that software development is something you really can do without having a lot of process. So, for instance, the agile community have emphasized what we call tacit knowledge. You know, tacit knowledge is implicit. You really don't define the knowledge. You don't describe it. You can only teach basically mouth to mouth or in training. That works in some situations, but it's not really something that you can scale up easily. You can do it. I believe strongly we can make agile methods for large organizations. So that's one of the things I'm working with.
Well, so and for those that missed what you said there, I think that was Agile would be the way I would say that word.
Yes, yes.
I only say that because sometimes on the podcast it's hard for people to decipher.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. Tacit knowledge, another way might be just the knowledge that you gain by experience.
Yes.
And so you look at someone who's very, very experienced and they just do the right thing from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But that's often the result of years of doing the wrong thing and learning what didn't work, which, of course, I think is probably one of the reasons why there's an emphasis on working in very tightly collaborative situations like pair programming and so mm-hmm. forth. Because, it, like you said, it gives you that mouth-to-mouth kind of, which is another interesting expression, actually.
I mean, it may be a Swedish expression. I'm sorry for that.
Yeah, well, mouth-to-mouth development. I don't know if that sounds very good. No, but I'm thinking of, you know...
Oh, you just invented a new buzzword. You know, we really need a new buzzword. It's 2 years... No, it's 1 year since we had the last one. So M&M methodology, okay.
There we go. I don't know if I want to be that close to my colleagues, okay, but... I think there is a lot of benefit. As I looked at... my experience with pair programming, initially you think, you kind of react like, that's going to waste a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Here you've got two people just focused on one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't it cut our productivity by half? Mm-hmm. And yet, we came to realize that the knowledge transfer was much, much richer than we could have ever done any other way. Yeah. And also, the net result of the pair working together produced a synergy that meant that the end result was better than we would have achieved working independently.
Yes, and I'm really a strong fan of these ideas. Now, I would like to see a pair that is very knowledgeable, can deal with all the details, and can support me in basically anything I'm doing. And I believe, and so... I've been working with for quite 5 years now to develop pairs that actually are intelligent agents to help me do the job. So, and these guys are never tired. They are experts, can become experts in a particular little niche area. They can take over, 80% of the work we do in the middle of a software is no brain work. That's one of the amazing facts, 80%. So I believe that we can at least move over 50% of that to intelligent agents. And we have seen very good results in doing that, actually. Now, I'm not going to promote more of that, but this is what I've used the term smart process. Instead of using having humans to do all these mundane tasks that you need to do if you really follow some process, you can have agents to do that. So I talk about virtual pair programmer, virtual pair analyst. So not only programming, it's actually analyst, it's designer, it's project manager, it's tester, any role you play.
So as I like the idea that you said that eventually we want to get to the phase where the process is intuitive. It's just
yes.
Like the way we drive a car. The reason that we can successfully talk on our mobile phone while we're driving the car is that it is so intuitive.
It is intuitive, yes.
Yeah, we don't have to think very much about pushing on the gas, I'm holding the wheel.
When you brake, 20 things happen.
Yeah.
You don't care.
Yeah.
But when we program, develop software, when we brake there or similar things, there are 20 things we have to do manually that should be done by some smart tools.
So the question is, what is it going to take to get us from this very manual, intensive process that we have to think a lot about to the day when we have a very intuitive process that we just do but don't think much about?
Do you ask me what technology we need to do that?
Or? Well, what is it? Is it a technology? Is it a tooling answer? Is it a, you know, better education? Or what do you think will it take?
Well, I think actually there are several things. It's not only about tools, and it's not only about processes. It's also platforms. we need to get actually better platforms than we have today. The platforms we have today, and I'm not going to advertise any one of them, they are better than we ever have had, but still they are not that intuitive. So it means that if you're really going to develop some significant piece of software, you need to have more than just the technology that comes from the vendor. So I think that will happen. We'll see an evolution of platforms that will support better software development. We also will see a better process. We'll see better tools. The tools today are better than we had 10 years ago, but still not good enough, or maybe okay. And so it's many, many factors which happen. But from what I can do, and with my background and experience, is that I can improve what we are doing significantly. And I've been working with, as you know, what today is called unified process, rational unified process. But the next step here, there are two steps. One, as I mentioned earlier, is using intelligent agents to help deliver knowledge when you need it, not before. So it doesn't matter if it's if there is a huge knowledge base, because you only get what you need when you need it. But that's one track that I believe is on the track to the future. The other track is to actually simplify what we have and focus on the essence of these ideas. So we have identified five core practices, foundation practices. these practices are such that if you can take one, two, or all five, and they are not mandatory, but with good likelihood you will improve your practices, your development practices, if you adopt them. Now, you talked about buzzwords. I mean, we need a new buzzword. We have so many buzzwords. One of the problems, every time we introduce a new buzzword, like service-oriented architecture, enterprise architecture, you can take them all, including active, what I call active software, or agile software development. People really think, or actually promote this practice, a new methodology, completely new things. You start all over. Whatever you knew before, throw it out. You have to do something new. And we've been doing that in the software industry for 40, 50 years. I really believe there are some core practices that you can base your work on. And one of them is component-based development, for instance. I mean, really, you can't develop software with a good software architecture without components. And models is also there. You need to have models for different groups of people. You have code, you have models for requirements and business models and so on. And there are five of these practices that I consider foundation practices. But if you have these practices, you can then build service-oriented architecture easily with adding a new practice or reverse engineering, re-engineering legacy code. So these different things are just practices. Or software reuse, asset-based development.
So, you know, as you were talking about the ways in which the operating systems need to get better,
yeah.
I was thinking about, you know, going back to the analogy of driving, how the first car that I had a manual transmission. And now, as a teenage boy, I thought that was pretty cool.
You know,
because I really liked, you know.
I still like it in some situations, but I need a better motor too in that case.
Yeah,
you had 20 years ago.
That's true. But you know, it meant that I had to be very cognizant of the operation of the engine and what the RPMs were and, you know, how it was going to go. And I had to push in the clutch and change the gear and so forth. I had to think about it constantly. But as I got older, I came to think, well, you know, an automatic transmission is not such a bad thing, you know, especially when you have a 3-year-old child in the back seat who's crying or something like that, right? I'm not thinking about it. I'm just driving and the car is automatically doing the right thing for me. But as you pointed out, it's not always as optimal as I would do it exactly on my own.
No.
You know, particularly there are times when you go, wow, I kind of wish I had that manual. And sometimes there's just the thrill of it, right? But I think that we are seeing very incremental changes down that path. I can, in a particular way, I think about the web services stack.
Yes.
We've had a very sort of workable but primitive stack And now we're on the verge of having Windows Communication Foundation, which has a much superior stack that can do a lot of things for me automatically that previously would have taken much, much work for me to do. So I think these are the kind of things that are getting us down that road. But
absolutely, yes.
The other thing that was interesting to me as you were talking about these disciplines of the five foundational disciplines of architecture, it occurred to me that many universities, you know, kind of lump all of computer science into one bucket. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you kind of learn everything, but there's not really, I don't know, maybe there are, but I'm not aware of universities that kind of look at architecture, especially software architecture, mm-hmm. as a distinctly different discipline than say, the typical computer science program.
Yes. So there are, typically there are universities in this space, but they typically are not in the developed countries.
Ah.
That's really interesting. You know, in developed countries, the professors usually come with a very good computer science background and never really develop any commercial software.
Yeah.
And they are very proud of their experience and background. So that's what their students, they teach their students. Whereas in the not developed world, what do you call it? I mean...
The developing world.
Developing world, yes. Yeah. They are more listening to what's going on, and they need to think about software engineering and so on. So, for instance, I was in Lima 4 years ago, and I had... I had 750 students there, and I asked, how many of you know about unified modeling language? And 750 people raised their hands. And then I asked, how many know about unified process? 750 people raised their hands. They were studying it. That was, by the way, one of the funniest days in my life.
You'll never see that again.
not only for that reason. because after my talk, I had these 750 people were about 50% men and 50% women, and so these girls, they all came down to the stage and wanted my autograph, and so I wrote 375 autographs, and you know, they wanted it. Basically, some came with a piece of paper, so I wrote on the paper. Some had a book, I wrote in the book, and some. We didn't have anything like that, so they wanted me to write on their T-shirt. And some wanted me to write underneath a T-shirt, too. Just here.
Wow. Yeah, on the arm. Yes, on the arm. Okay. Phew. All right.
You wow. Probably have to cut that away.
Well, you know, this is it's an important step towards building this common understanding. As In the previous session here at the conference, we were talking about the work that ISA is doing, mm-hmm. Around even defining the profession of architecture as software architecture, mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of interesting as I reflect back on most of the people I know who are whose job title says architect. Mm-hmm. That means the guy who's been around here the longest, usually.
And really not promoted that way.
Yeah. What are we going to call him? He's an architect. That's okay. What, you know, he's been around here a long time.
We need to give him a good title.
Yeah, but it occurred to me that when I first started in the industry, we used to talk about people as system analysts. Mm-hmm. And system analyst was a guy that thought a lot about the use cases and the, you know, they drew lots of flow charts. They never wrote any code.
That's that's a word for that is hand wavers.
And exactly, that's what I'm doing here. Waving
yeah,
my
hand
hands,
wavers.
You know, and they would say, well, this is what we're going to build, and then they would hand it over to the programmers. Yeah, and then there was a subtle shift. I started seeing in the 90s they started having this job classification called programmer analyst, which I think was a way of saying the old method didn't work very well, because in the process of the hand waving and the flow charts and throwing over the wall, the message got lost somehow.
Yeah.
And so then we decided that the programmers could do the analysis, but at the same time, I think we lost a little bit in the sense of saying that every programmer is now an architect.
Has to be an analyst too, yes.
Yeah. So we need a distinct architecture discipline.
Absolutely.
But I think the vast improvements we've learned about are how do we rigorously and precisely describe the architecture in a way that could be implemented by the programmers. Mm. Now, let me ask you about something I wonder about with Agile. As I talk to a lot of my Agile friends, you sometimes think that the software almost grows organically, that it's almost as if we were to say, well, we'll put some seeds in this pot and pour water on it and see what springs up. Mm. We're not sure what we're going to end up with, but we think it'll be useful, and we'll kind of have several iterations and see what comes out of the pot. But I think that makes a lot of people nervous because they say, well, what is the architecture you're working with here? How do you react to that?
Well, I think there are two aspects of this. And we actually talk about agile with discipline. So we believe there are lots of value in the agile community, but not everything they talk about as being agile is very specific to agile. It's actually used in other practices as well. For instance, today in a previous discussion, one of the other panelists mentioned that iterative development is agile, and iterative development is used in many different methodologies. It's not only there which is agile. So there are ideas that now are merged together, and some of them are really new. One of the things that I think really is new contributions when it comes to the agile methodologies is what is called social engineering practices. Social engineering is about how you train people, how you, for instance, pair programming. It's about how you actually organize your teams, how you run a project. And for instance, one of the interesting discoveries I did just a year ago or so, I read Scrum, the book. I've read both books of Scrum, and I actually loved them. Because one of the things I said, oh, is this really what's meant by agile? And I remember that when I personally worked as a project manager, I felt working in this style is very, very similar to how we worked. Now, we didn't have a terminology for this, so I think this methodology really contribute in terms of explaining and giving a terminology to what agile means. So I see now what I'm working with now, basically three different approaches is coming together into what we call a central unified process. And that is, of course, the practices that we have developed and refined over years that really have made many companies successful. But it's also CMMI, for instance. Many companies really want to be able to improve our process. But the way CMMI is done is very heavyweight today. So that needs to also to be done in an agile way. And then we have the agile and social engineering practices that really makes it much more fun to develop software. So I feel these three things have to go together. And when we, in our work on the central unified process, we actually integrate all these three things in a way that makes it lightweight to adopt it. So, I mean, CMMI is something that everyone talks about today, in particular if you go to East Asia or to India, of course. But even in the U.S., many companies talk about it.
Yeah, you know,
but it needs to be done in an agile fashion. Otherwise, people hate it. You heard me mention 80% of the work is no brain work. And I asked several of these big companies when I had an audience with 400 or 500 people from, for instance, one of the big companies. And I asked, what do you think of, how many of you love CMMI? Three people. These were the process freaks, you know, okay. Then I asked, how many of you hate CMMI? And it was about 60-70% at five different companies. And And then I asked about this no brain work. How much do you think is no brain work? And they said 95%. Because it's so much boring work we have to do to implement CMMI. But we know CMMI is good for their company because the company gets a very good recognition. But it's so much no brain work.
Well, there's a fundamental truth here. People will not do a process they hate.
No, that's true. So it needs to be fun.
Yeah, that's right.
But you know, in the old days, we were selling to process freaks. The process freaks loved our process. So we need to, I mean, this is fundamentally different now when we talk about essential unified process.
Well, that's what is so intriguing about Agile.
Yes.
Is that the people who do it love it.
Absolutely. So we understand it's important to be there.
Well, and what was interesting to me is that Microsoft, if you've ever been to the Microsoft campus, their original vision was that every developer should have their own private office. You know, it's pretty great, you know, coming from some other places where we were large, you know, what they called cube farms, right? And so I thought it was just luxurious to get into my own private office. I could close the door, I could play music, you know, it was kind of interesting. But then I came to this strange and wonderful patterns and practices team there in Redmond, and they started this project called Enterprise Library. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about Enterprise Library. It's been a very successful project. And the team did this crazy thing. They took over a conference room that was right across the hall from my office. And I was the product manager, so they didn't let me in the door. But they took over the architects, the developers, the testers. They were crammed in there, 15 people, wall to wall. I mean, they literally were elbow to elbow, close to mouth, very close to that. And they worked.
I think we have it.
They worked nonstop on Enterprise Library for several months. Afterwards, we recorded a couple of podcasts about that whole process. And I said, why did you do that? And they said there was so much value in being that close, in being able to move very quickly, make decisions with, you know, instead of having to go, well, we'll have a meeting next Tuesday and we'll try to sort this out. No, they would just turn around their chairs and they'd say, we have a problem here. What are we going to do about this? And everybody would get their ideas out and they'd very quickly make a decision.
Yes. Yes.
And if a developer had an issue, he could talk to the architect. If a tester had a problem, he could talk to the developer. Very, very quickly,
yes.
As they were all in one place. And it was a novel concept for Microsoft. In fact, our general manager had to get special permission from the facilities people to let us control that conference room for 6 months.
I didn't know Microsoft was that old-fashioned.
But it's changing, I'm telling you. In fact, we sparked a whole new thing because the people who control the facilities there, they sent a special team to investigate what is happening here, that this group is working in the conference room and that they're building a whole new facility for patterns and practices that's oriented around Agile. Mm-hmm. And since that time, I found out that many other groups in Microsoft are doing the same thing because they see the benefits of this working together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
that's a 50-year-old, at least, idea.
You see, well, you know, sometimes it takes a while to get through. Okay. it's a cultural change.
Yes.
A wonderful one. I think once you've done it, you don't ever want to go back.
Totally agree. My surprise is that this is what really good people do. Much of these things really good people do without knowing it's Agile. But of course it helps if you can explain it and you have a number of ideas. So, and this is what we are integrating now in.
Well, I was really intrigued by the idea that you've organized your process into cards. It's like a card game. You know, we're going to sit down and play
and
a game.
And actually, we deliver with this a number of games. So we can actually play it too, not only we. When you develop it, the idea is that you play chords, but actually we have games of this game to just have fun.
So you can go to the CIO and say, and you know, we're going to play some games tomorrow.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
I'm sure that will go
over
well.
Maybe I can ask the audience something. How many of you would like to know more about the central unified process? Great. Then yeah. I can tell you. There. We are going to have a process launch on the 27th of June. Please go to our website and register. You're most welcome.
And what's the website?
It's ivarjakobsen.com.
Oh, okay. ivarjakobsen.com. Okay. See, there you go.
You can spell it. Pronounce it Ivar Jacobsen, too. It's okay.
See, and I have ronjacobs.com. That's a wonderful thing to have your own name, to own the URL for your name, because it makes it convenient for people to find you. Well, Ivar, I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today, and I'm sure the audience, the two or three people that raised their hands moments ago, almost everyone in the room was very interested in learning more about this, and what could be more fun? And so thank you so much for joining me today on ArtCast.
You started with a joke.
Oh, okay. You want to finish with one?
Can I finish with a joke?
Oh, please do.
I mean, the idea is, what I believe is that we will get more support, smart support in developing software. And I call that smart process. So when I stood up and talked about this, I was asked, what do you mean by smart process? So what does smart really mean? So then I remember a joke told by an old friend of mine many, many years ago. This was two guys, two fools were standing on the street and saying, I wonder how you become rich. So one guy, one of the fools, he said, oh, he is a guy, he has a very expensive car, he must be rich, I'll go and ask him. So he walked over to the young guy stepping out in sunglasses and looked very rich. And so he says, sir, can you please tell me how you become rich? And the rich guy said, you have to be smart. Smart, what does that mean? Oh, I'll show you. So he took his hand up and put it in front of a trunk, a tree, and asked the fool to hit him. Hit me as hard as you can. Oh, no, sir, I can't really hit you. Yeah, please do that, hit me. So after a little hesitation, he finally hit as hard as he could. But just when he was about to hit the rich guy took away his hand, and of course he hit the trunk, and it was very painful. And so the rich guy said, that's what it means to be smart. You can't be hit. And now the fool walks over to his colleague, and he said, the colleague said, do you know how to become rich? Yes, you have to be smart. Smart, what does it mean to be smart? I'll show you. And he looked around, he couldn't find a tree, so he said, hit me as hard as you can.
Well, and for those who won't see that... let's just say you had to be there. Okay. Well, thanks again, Ivar, for joining me today on ArtCast, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Ivar Jacobsen, ladies and gentlemen, live from the Celtic Manor Resort in Newport, Wales. That was a lot of fun. You know, doing this in front of an audience, who knows? This could become, you know, my regular thing. In fact, I'm going to do more of these. And I'm going to be at Vail, Colorado shortly for the North American Architect Forum here in a couple weeks, where I'll be interviewing a bunch of people. But I have many more recordings to come from the UK event, the Architecture Insight Conference, which was a terrific success and a lot of fun. And we'll hear people like Martin Fowler and Ian Robinson from ThoughtWorks and so many others. You're going to like it. You're going to love it. Trust me. Tell your friends and tune in to ArtCast.